So that we'll get started and they'll join us. So as I was saying, the events in Boston, I thought it would be appropriate that our learning this evening should be Le'ilei Nishmas, those who have passed away. And for those who are still, thank God, clinging to life, God should have mercy on them and should be merachem aleihem, and our learning should be as a zechus for a speedy recovery for those who've been injured. Okay. The title this evening is Joseph Upon Further Reflection, Biblical Interpretation and Theology in Exile, which is a mouthful, but what it boils down to, I think, is the following story. My father has a very dear friend who is both an enormous Talmud Chacham and a lawyer. And he he volunteers a great deal of his time to help out those in the ultra-Orthodox community who require legal services. So oftentimes it's for legitimate reasons, and other times it is for illegitimate reasons. He once expressed to my father a degree of frustration at some of the shenanigans that his clients were pulling. And he said to my father, "You have to understand, sometimes they just see the world in a completely different way than we do, to the point where they're reading the English language differently than we are. So we'll go to a beach, and the beach will say, danger, no swimming allowed. And we'll look at it and we'll say, okay, it's dangerous to go on the beach, and that is why we may not swim there. And then we'll walk away. He said, my clients will look at the same sign and they'll read it as follows. Danger? No, swimming allowed. And they'll just go on to the beach. In other words, reading, even the simple act of reading, is always a diversifying interpretative experience. Now, what does that mean? Whenever you read anything, the mere act of articulating what you've read, or even not articulating it, just selecting a passage to read, any act of reading is by definition interpretative. You are by definition giving a parish, so to speak, on what you've read. Why? Because by selecting a piece to read, an excerpt from a larger work to read, so what you've done is you said, I believe that this excerpt, that these sentences belong together. Even if you can all agree, even if you read the entire work, the way that you inflect words, right? Danger, no, swimming allowed. The way that you inflect words is interpretative. So you can say, he doesn't like cake. Or you can say, he doesn't like cake? Crazy. So the act of reading is by definition interpretative. Now, why is this important? We're used to thinking of parshanut, of exegesis, of biblical material, as beginning with, so if I ask who's the earliest biblical exegete? So if you asked me, my answer would have been, who's the earliest biblical exegete, if I asked? Just throw out who are the names that we're familiar with.
Okay,
so we're already getting a little advanced. I would have said Rashi. If you asked me in 12th grade, I would have said Rashi. Even better, I would have said Uncleus, right? Any act of translation is certainly an act of interpretation. So I would have said Uncleus. If I want to get fancy and academic, I would have said Philo, I would have said Josephus, late Second Temple figures. Depends which Midrashim. By and large, none of them are predate Uncleus, most likely. The earliest Midrash, to the best of my knowledge, is the Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael, whose core dates from the 2nd to 3rd centuries, but which has later editions that last until the 7th century, or the 8th century. The Midrashim, by and large, are early to very, very late medieval period. The Sifra, for instance, is an early Midrash, the Midrash on Vayikra, whereas Midrash Lekach Tov, which you may have come across, is medieval. So if I want to get fancy, I'll say Philo and Josephus. So if I really want to be sophisticated, I'll give Saleh's answer, which is Tehillim. What do you mean by Tehillim?
He talks about how Hashem created the world and the way the forces of the world
right.
work, and he also gives his own interpretation of his story. It's not
right.
It's just his perspective on the story.
Exactly. So that's exactly. I mean, that's exactly it. If Tehillim retells the act of creation, so the way in which it tells it, it's not quoting directly.
Right.
It's paraphrasing. So what is in Tehillim and what is left out of Tehillim? There are Mizmorim that talk about Yitzias Mitzrayim. So in Yitzias Mitzrayim, what is Arba'im Shana Akut Bedar V'Amar Am Toilei Vavim? Right, in the very beginning of Kabbalah Shabbos, Tehillim talks about the process or the sojourn of the Jewish people in the desert. And it focuses particularly on the points at which the Bnei Yisrael complain. So why is that an interpretative act? Because it's left out all the other. It left out Kabbalah Satorah. It left out a bunch of other things. So by selecting parts of the narrative, it is by definition interpreting interpreting Tanakh. Now, what we can take away from this is that already in Tanakh itself, we are dealing with Parshanut HaMikra. We're dealing with biblical exegesis. Now, what we saw last week, just as a very, very brief recap, was that last week we saw, we began to examine the process, or we just got started. Here is a source sheet, no problem. John, this is it. We just got started. Here's a source sheet. Here's a source sheet for you.
Thank you.
Awesome. Okay. So as we were just saying, the act of any act of just to cover quickly what you missed, any act of reading Tanakh whatsoever, the way you inflect words, the selections that you choose to read from Tanakh, is by definition an interpretation of Tanakh. Now, why is this important? Just to quickly recap what we did last week. Last week we examined the very beginning of the period of the return to Zion, the very beginning of the period of Shivat Zion, which documents the Jewish return from the Babylonian exile after the first temple was destroyed in the year 586 BCE until the year 539 BCE, when Cyrus, the first emperor of the Persian Empire, allowed the Jewish people to return back to Zion, to the land of Israel, and begin to rebuild the second temple. And just a note on the source sheet. The very first thing that I've given you, we're not going to refer to it at any point. All it is a way to orient yourself. As I mentioned last time, if you ever feel at any point that you need to sort of get a handle on where we are chronologically, feel free to refer back to it at any time. No, we are not going to mention any dates over the course of this lecture that are not contained in this timeline. So if you ever need to orient yourself, that is where you can do it. What we saw last time as well, more importantly, and we didn't explore this theme so much in Yeshaya, but it's very much prevalent there. We explored it more in the context of Sefer Ezra, was that for those prophets and those theological history writers like Ezra and Nehemiah, who were promoting the cause of Shivat Zion, of the return to Zion, so first and foremost, they were doing so over the objection of those Jews who objected religiously to Shivat Zion, because they thought that the return to Zion could not be promoted or could not be prosecuted via the agency of Gentiles or of idolaters or of those Jews who aren't devoted to Torah in the way that we would wish. So the Nevi'im and Ezra and Nehemiah vigorously opposed such a view. And promoted what we might call somewhat anachronistically, but I think also accurately, by and large, a religious Zionism. Now, the way that they made this argument is not via Midrashim, not via citations of Chazal. Of course, they didn't have them in front of them. What was available to a Jew in this period in terms of bolstering himself theologically, bolstering his arguments theologically? What texts were available?
Torah,
right? There was Chumash. There were the Nevi'im that predated the Second Temple period, like Yeshaya, like Hosea, like Amos, Shoftim, and the like. And most importantly, Chumash. So the way in which we saw last time, the way in which Ezra, at least, buttressed his argument for Shivat Zion, for the legitimacy of Shivat Zion, was by paralleling his account of the Jewish return to the land of Israel on the Exodus, on Yetzias Mitzrayim. And of course, if you think about it, the parallels are obvious. Just as in the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Jews are in captivity in a foreign land, just as in Yetzias Mitzrayim, a Gentile king allows them to leave their land and sends them out and sends them on their way, just like with Yetzias Mitzrayim, they leave Bekesev Zahav Uberachush Uvavahimah, The Psukim in Ezra explicitly model that. We didn't have a chance to see, but later in Ezra, we see that the Jews travel by tribe. They cross a sea, and so on and so forth. There's tons of Yetzias Mitzrayim imagery in Sefer Ezra. Now, what I'd like to do this time is, instead of focusing on the community in Eretz Yisrael, because we're going to have ample time to focus on that community, not next week, but the week after, when we begin talking about the end of Daniel and the lead up to the Hasmonean revolt and the persecutions of Antiochus IV, we're going to do in 2 weeks a real primer on the history of the Hellenistic period post Alexander the Great. As well, of course, we're going to cover Alexander the Great. But we're going to return to Eretz Yisrael in about 2 weeks. This week, what I'd like to do, and next week in a different context, but this week, what I'd like to do is turn our attention to those communities who did not join the Aliyah, who did not return to Zion. Now, as mentioned, the prophets, Yeshaya in particular, Haggai, and the theological history writers, Ezra and Nehemiah, polemicize against those who objected to Zionism. They polemicize against anti-Zionists within their ranks. They do not polemicize, they have nothing to say at all about, for good, for bad, or for good. They have nothing to say about those who don't object in principle to Shivat Zion, but don't return. Meaning, by implication, these people are failing to fulfill a central principle of Jewish faith, as Rabbi Friedman pointed out in his public lecture, very ably. But what they are not doing, meaning they are not treated in the same way that the anti-Zionists are. The anti-Zionists are castigated or excoriated by the Nevi'im. But those who stay, for whatever reason, so it's understood that they are not performing a very important duty that they have. It's not, as Rabbi Friedman said, not a lifestyle choice, it's an obligation. But these Nevi'im have nothing to say about what happens to this community. There's a tendency within contemporary Jewish thought, and I say contemporary, by contemporary I mean really post-Zionist, but most importantly post-67 war. Contemporary Jewish thought has not paid attention really at all to this community. It seems to me it has been negligent in doing so because it's our community. Our question, I think, should be, what does this community do if it's not being part of Shivat Zion? So, Micha, that it's not fulfilling a central tenet of its religious experience. But if it's not anti-Zionist, if it's not anti-Shivat Zion, is there a sense in which this community has some identity, has some important role to play, perhaps a role that cannot be played by those who return to Zion? So what I'd like to, God bless you, what I'd like to explore this evening is that question. How did... welcome. Here is a sorshi for you. Oh, that's as good a reason as any. Speaking of Shivat Zion, okay. Oh, all right. Oh, fantastic.
Tell me, was there any difference between in the 1930s when Jabotinsky went through Eastern Europe and told the Jews to liquidate the diaspora and what the Rabbanim told them not to do?
Well, essentially, I think the two are paralleled in what we saw last week, which is that Yeshaya is telling everybody, let's go back. We should make a mesila in the Midbar. We should make a path through the desert, through the wilderness, and head back to Israel. Whereas everybody else seems to be saying that we can't go back because Koresh, because Cyrus is an idolater, and how can we listen to idolaters who tell us what to do? So what I'd like to do now is ask the following question. Yes?
Were those 70 years, were they all clustered in one place? Did they spread out and make their own?
So we have some information. There's archaeology and there's Tanakh. So archaeologically speaking, Yechezkel tells us, literarily speaking, Yechezkel tells us that there was a big community of exiles at Tel Aviv, the original Tel Aviv. Which is a good, which, I mean, in Hebrew it's sort of Mound of Springs, but really it's a good Akkadian name, Tel Abibu, which which, if I'm not mistaken, just means next to the river or something like that. Actually, it's something a little bit worse than that. I remember when I first learned the Akkadian that I was somewhat disappointed. I like the Hebrew valence better. But Tel Aviv in Babylonian is the city of Nippur, which if you have that map right there, and it should be, it's not on this source sheet, but for anyone who's interested, I've uploaded it to Dropbox. It will be on YU Torah, toot sweet in the words of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. But Nippur is just near Babylon. And remains of the Jewish community have been found there, documents and names and so on and so forth. That's a whole interesting lecture in and of itself. So they're clustered mostly in that area. There are those who fled to Egypt, who are also excoriated by the Nevi'im, those who didn't go to Babel, those who were sort of Porish Menat Sibor, so to speak, and went their own way to Egypt. Sof kol sof, there is a large Jewish community in Egypt that flourishes. They're eventually decimated in a revolt. They're decimated in a rebellion that is put down brutally by the Romans in the year 117 of the Common Era, which is called the Quietus Rebellion. We'll get to that in the second to last class, I believe. What I'd like to ask now is the following question: given that we do have books in Tanakh that operate from the perspective of those who experienced the exile but did not live to experience Shivat Zion, A. And B, we have books written by those who lived in the diaspora while the Beis HaMikdash was already built and don't seem to have cared. The question is, how did those people, these are those books, those writers, who did not object to Shivat Zion but simply didn't become a part of it, how did they justify their existence? What theological model did they construct for themselves? Of course, as we said before, if they're going to construct a theological model, it had to be on the basis of which texts? Chumash, Nevi'im, and so on and so forth. So what did they use? They can't use Yetzias Mitzrayim. Yetzias Mitzrayim obviously militates in the other direction. So what did they use? So the answer, just to give you a sense of where we're going this evening, the answer is going to be that all of these books, and in particular I refer to the very last four psukim of Melachim Beis, which essentially tells what happened after the destruction of the first temple. It details the last days of King Jehoiachin, who was the second to last king of Judea, who was exiled along with the elite of Yerushalayim in 597 BCE, and the exiles who went with him, all of whom are described by Yirmiyahu in a prophecy we looked at last week, as the ones who will lead the redemption. So in any event, Melachim Beis concludes on a short note about Jehoiachin. Modern scholars like Tadmor and Kogan have argued that it's so out of context for Melachim Beis, it must be an addition by a later author. I think if you look at the text itself, it actually relates very well to the rest of the book and is crucial, I think, to the book's message going forward. So we're going to look at those psukim that detail that give us a coda about what happened to the Jews when they went into exile. Then we're going to look at Megillas Esther. Megillas Esther, archaeologically, this can be borne out beyond the shadow of a doubt. It's not immediately obvious, and Chazal certainly did not believe this. But Chazal had their own reasons for not making this point. It is true beyond the shadow of a doubt. I gave a shiur on this just before Purim at the Jewish Center. For those who are interested, we can discuss this afterwards. It is clear beyond the shadow of a doubt that Megillas Esther takes place long after Bayis Sheni was already constructed. That's point number two. And then we're going to look at Daniel. Daniel is set in between the destruction of the first temple and the building of the second temple. However, it's clear for a variety of reasons that both halves of Daniel, there are two halves of Daniel. There's Perek Aleph through Perek Vav, and then there's Perek Zion through Perek Yabez. Both of Perek Zion through Perek Yabez we're going to deal with in two classes. It was composed during the Hellenistic period, which already the Rishonim are aware of. But the first half of Daniel is set in between Bayis Rishon and Bayis Sheni, but due to a variety of considerations, not least of which is the the tons of Persian loanwords in it, as well as the fact that it's Aramaic, is a very late dialect of Aramaic. Not very late, but rather late dialect of Aramaic. We can conclude that Daniel, and this is it's true for a host of other reasons that we don't have to get into now, Daniel was as well written during the Persian period, and we can surmise that it was written after the temple was already built, or just as it was being built. Certainly in the period after Shivat Zion had already begun. We're going to examine how those three works deal with the question of how to live in the diaspora if there's a temple right next door. How do we do this? The argument that we're going to make over the course of the evening is that their primary justification for their existence, their entire existence, was the character and the story of Yosef, Yosef HaTzadik. So now, if we think about it for just a moment, I think it's rather obvious why they might choose Yosef. So what are some? So I want this to be a little bit more collaborative than last time. Why might they have chosen Yosef for a model?
Well, ultimately, Yosef's position where he was saved them from the famine where they were.
Right.
So like setting him up in a place that's not where they are.
Right.
Essentially, could be like lucrative for everybody. Like for
the right. And you might sort of model it on, let's say, the situation today. Israel exists in large part because it's been protected and funded by America, and which is the result of the efforts of American Jews and European Jews and so on and so forth. That might be one model. What might be another reason? Where does Yosef's story take place?
In the diaspora.
Right. What was then Egypt, but what is now the diaspora? So now, I want to actually ask a follow-up on that question. So it takes place, I said, where does it take place? So Ms. Deegan said the diaspora. Now, diaspora, I think, implies the existence of a certain something, and that is something I would call empire. Why do I say that? After the Jews are exiled, so what happens to them? They are at the mercy of those who exiled them. So when the Assyrians exile the northern kingdom of Israel, Malchut Yisrael, they are at the mercy, presumably, we don't know what happened to them, but they're at the mercy, presumably, of the Assyrians. When the people of Lachish, the city of Lachish, are assaulted by Melech Sanherib, the king of Ashur, when he assaults Judea, although Jerusalem isn't captured, and that he's defeated in the battle in 701 BCE. That is not on the timeline, I apologize. The Jews of Lachish are massacred by Sanherib. You can go to the British Museum Ad Hayom Hazeh, and you can look at the Lachish reliefs, which Sanherib constructed himself, which depicts his battle against the Judeans at the city of Lachish, and you can see these Assyrians with nice, long rabbinic beards attacking Jews who have these nice trimmed early 20th century American style beards, and you can see just the destruction that the Assyrians wrought on the Jewish people. Once the first temple was destroyed, the Jews are at the mercy of Babylonians. So the question becomes: how do we relate to the empire that is ruling over us now? And more importantly, how do we theologically understand the situation in which it seems that we are not as powerful as God had promised us we would be? This is an issue we raised last time. What do we do if God has promised us glory, or at least we think God promised us glory, even though if we read Devarim for just a second, we'd see that there's plenty of tochacha to go around. How do we deal with the fact that these Babylonians, these idolaters, seem to have the theological upper hand? How do we deal with that? In Yosef, so that's what I think all of that is packed into the term diaspora, all of those anxieties, all of that existential angst. In the Yosef story, one of the points that we're going to make in a moment is that I don't believe that that's present in the Yosef story. The Yosef story doesn't take place in the diaspora so much as it takes place in a foreign country, in Egypt. Now, what else happens in the Yosef story?
Well, the Yosef story, he was living in two different worlds.
Excellent point. That was the point that was one of the major points I'd like to get at.
He was a short distance from his homeland.
Right.
And he didn't return to his homeland.
Right. Very good. Oh, that's another point.
Only when he went to bury his father.
Right. Very good. And even then, he buried his father in the manner of the Egyptians. He had his father embalmed, and he had himself buried in an aron. He's the only person in Jewish history, aside from Melech Asa, which is a different case entirely, who's buried in a box. Archaeologically speaking, we can prove that Jews did not bury in boxes. They just had burials in the earth. The only people in the ancient world who buried in boxes, let alone big tombs, were the Egyptians. Why? What boxes did they use? Sarcophagi. They were mummies. Means he had Yaakov in bond. Fact. In the British Museum, they had an exhibit 2 years ago on the Book of the Dead, which was the Egyptian instructions for how to embalm a person. And if you look at the amount of days that it takes to embalm someone, followed by the amount of days it takes to mourn them, the numbers are replicated exactly in Bereishis. So it's clear that that Yosef, even when making end-of-life decisions, and even once he'd been reunited with his father, he was still living his life in many ways as an Egyptian. So Yosef really is living in two different worlds. And he's more importantly, he's merging them seamlessly. I think it's not for nothing that he was called Yosef HaTzadik.
His whole family came with him. There was nobody left in Eretz Israel. Esau was there.
Right. So
there was nobody else there. You know?
Right, so now we're all in the diaspora. This is our big community. Right. Exactly, very much so. So now the question is, once we can establish all of these similarities, I would like to take a quick look at some of the differences, because that's going to allow us to see how the Jews of the Second Temple period read Yosef and interpreted Yosef. So now, if you look at the second section on your source sheets, elements of the Yosef narrative. So number one, what is the function? What is the point of the Yosef narrative? What overall message is the Yosef story attempting to convey to us? So if you look at the first pasuk I've given you, Vayomer l'Avraham, Yadoa teida, ki ger yihyeh zaracha be'eretz lo lahem, v'avadum v'inu osam arba me'il shana. Hashem said to Avraham, when he makes his original covenant with him, he says to him, whatever you do, whatever happens, just know that at the end of all of this, for 400 years, your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they'll be enslaved and mistreated there. So in other words, going down to Mitzrayim, it really didn't have to be Mitzrayim. It could have been anywhere. Eretz lo lahem. Bereishis specifies Mitzrayim at different points. But really, the fact that it was Egypt had nothing to do with anything. The covenant that God makes with Abraham has nothing to do, per se, with empire. Has nothing to do with the way in which the Jewish people relate to those who have been set over them. It has to do the bris bein habesarim, the covenant that God makes with Abraham, which is brought to fruition by Yosef's story, where he goes down to Egypt and then subsequently, as Sally said, drags everyone along with him. That story is entirely about the formation of an identity for the Jewish people. It's very much inward-looking, it's very much internal, and it has nothing to do, for the most part, with the experience of Egypt per se. And more importantly, what is Egypt? What is Egypt in the eyes of Bereishis? Is Egypt a power that needs to be reckoned with? I think the answer is no. We know the famous story about, when's the first time that we hear about Egypt and Bereishis? Think back. Yes, very good. When Avraham goes down because there's a famine in the land. So now, what do we know? So Avraham goes down, there's a famine in the land, he tells Paro that Sarah is his sister, we all know the story. Now, when else do we hear this story? It's like we almost hear the exact same story, and you forget that there are two of them. The same thing happens to Yitzchak. Same thing happens to Yitzchak. So Yitzchak goes down also, so he goes down to Egypt. Ah, but does he go down to Egypt? Where does Yitzchak go? So, in other words, the Tanakh makes the point of comparing Avraham to Yitzchak in many different ways. In many, many different ways. Both dig wells, both, you know, and so on and so forth. Both have children, one of whom they pass down the covenant, and the other of whom is essentially off the derech. And both of them experience a famine, go down, and almost lose their wife to a Gentile king. Now notice, I've given you two psukim side by side here. One is relates to Avram. Vahira av ba'aretz, vayered Avram mitzrayma, lagorshom ki chaveda para av ba'aretz. There was a famine in the land of Israel, and Abram went down to Egypt, and that was where he was. And if you look at the very pasuk next to it, which is how the story of Yitzhak's famine begins, Vayhira av ba'aretz milavadar av arishon, there was a new famine, asher hayah bimei Avraham, Vayelach Yitzhak al avimelech melech plishtim gerara. So this time he goes to the king of the Philistines. Mythological note, these are not the same Philistines that appear in the book of Judges. There are a variety of reasons why I say this, most important of which is that the Philistines in the book of Shoftim did not appear in the Levant, because they're Greeks, did not appear in the Levant until at earliest en masse, the 12th century before the Common Era, which is 200 years or so after this took place. But these are people, not the Philistines, but these are just people who live in the land of Pelesius. So now the point I'd like to make by juxtaposing these two verses is simply to say that these stories are not teaching us about the experience of empire, the experience of a Jew dealing with people who are stronger than him. It's about identity formation. These stories teach us something about who Abraham is as a person, who Yitzhak is as a person. They are people who, unfortunately, would compromise the honor of their wives in the hopes of saving themselves. These are stories that, as the Rishonim tell us, actually, the Ramban mentions this, are critical of Avram and Yitzchak. But the point is simply that the place where they went is so unimportant that in these psukim, they're essentially interchangeable. One went to Mitzrayim, one went to Grar, one went to the Plishtim. It doesn't really matter. The Yosef story, in other words, the fulfillment of the covenant with Avraham, which is what the Yosef story is, has nothing to do, for the most part, with how Jews relate to a very powerful foreign power, but mostly with about how they are essentially won over and formed and fashioned as God's people. That's why the Yosef story is important. It's the beginning of the journey, let's say, to Har Sinai. And each step along the way is logical and develops organically. It happens to be that that while Yosef is there, while Yosef is in Mitzrayim, he does navigate the currents of Gentile society and the challenges of a Gentile court and living in Gentile culture, and he does so rather deftly. That is an important element of the story, but it's not done from the perspective of how should Jews live in the diaspora. This is more about how should Yosef live in very difficult, trying circumstances. This is more about Yosef as an individual and less about the Jews as a people experiencing diaspora. Now, that is important because when we get to the Second Temple period, the entire framework, the entire intellectual, theological, emotional framework has shifted entirely to the point where that original framework is not just unrecognizable, it's undesirable. No one wants to read these stories anymore, nor should they, because Tanakh is meant to be Ladoros. Tanakh is meant to be meaningful generation after generation. So when the Second Temple period comes along, and now we're dealing with a situation in which Jews must live in a diaspora where there is a ruling power that is idolatrous and has this power over them, we essentially have to navigate this culture. So now the story of Yosef takes on an entirely new valence, an entirely new direction. The first way in which this story is reinterpreted, and I'd argue the earliest point at which this story is reinterpreted, and it's important to remember, Yosef, throughout Tanakh, until the source that we're about to look at, the very end of the First Temple period, Yosef as an actual character, as a biblical character, appears twice in Tanakh, both in Tehillim, and both in, once he's mentioned in one sentence, another one, it simply mentions that Yosef was in chains and then he escaped. Yosef is, as an actual biblical character, is not really discussed for the most part in the rest of Tanakh. Yosef's name becomes a byword for the northern kingdom, for the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim, who mostly ruled, who were the most powerful tribes in the northern kingdom. But Yosef is a biblical character, and the story of Yosef that we read in Bereishis appears nowhere in the rest of Tanakh. It's not discussed. We know Tanakh knows about it, because there are two Prakim and Tehillim that refer to the story. But the story itself is not seen as a crucial text that needs to be grappled with. That all changes. That's the genius of Chumash. That all changes when we get to the end of Bayishim. We're going to look at the next section now. Melachim Beit, Perek 25, which is Perek Chafei, which is the very end. This Perek, as we're about to see, was composed in the year 562 BCE. It's the very first year of the emperor, the Neo-Babylonian emperor, Amel Marduk, Evil Merodach in Tanakh. Amel Marduk is, I believe, two emperors after Nebuchadnezzar II. He's either one or two emperors after Nebuchadnezzar II. He rules for 2 years until his brother kills him and overthrows him, which was mostly par for the course in the Neo-Babylonian and Persian empires. Okay. So Neo-Babylonian Empire. The temple has been destroyed, and the Pasuk begins in the left-hand column. And I've given you the translations. I've given you first the Hebrew stuff, and then the next page underneath, you'll see the translations with. And in both the Hebrew and English, I've highlighted some of the key phrases. Vayhi b'shloshim v'sheva shana l'galus yehoyachin melech Yehuda b'shneimasar chodesh b'esrim mishava l'chodesh nasa evel merodach melech bavel b'shnas malcho es rosh yehoyachin melech Yehuda mi'beis kela. The temple has been destroyed. The Jews are in exile. And remember, in 597 BCE, which was the first time that the Babylonians had attacked Yehuda, Nebuchadnezzar had taken captive King Yehoyachin. He'd taken him into captivity in Babylonia, and he'd installed a puppet king, Zedekiah. Zedekiah ended up rebelling, and the temple was destroyed in 586 BCE, but he has Yehoyachin already in captivity. So now he's in captivity. Nebuchadnezzar has died, his successor has died, and now here is Amamarduk, the new emperor of the Babylonian Empire, and he sees Yehoyachin, the former king of Judea, languishing in prison. So what does he do? Nasa es rosh. He frees him. He lifts up his head. Bear that phrase in mind. And where does he take him out? From the base. He takes him out from the base kella. He takes him out of prison. This should already raise. Raise alarm bells, so to speak. If you look just across the way on the right hand side, it was Paro's birthday. This is back in Bereishis. And he made a party for all of his people. This is the only other time in Tanakh where that phraseology, Nasa Rosh, is used to refer to freeing someone from a prison. It's the only other time in Tanakh where the phraseology is used. And again, here a king is freeing a prisoner from a prisoner from prison. So we already have an echo of the Yosef story. It gets better. The next pasuk, back on the left-hand column. Vaydaber ito tovos. The king, Amamarduk, spoke well of Yehoyachin. Vayitenes kiso me'al kisei ha'melachim asher ito b'bavel. This is very strange phraseology. This means that of all the royal prisoners that he had, he appointed Yehoyachin sort of the chief of the prisoners. But the way in which this is expressed is in royal terms, which seems inappropriate. He put Yehoyachin's throne over the thrones of the other kings. Now, were any of them sitting on thrones? No. By definition, they all had their thrones brutally and violently wrested from them. So, this phraseology here seems out of context and seems almost mean and inappropriate until you realize that it is a direct reference to Yosef. If you look at the pasuk, the next pasuk that I've given you on the right-hand side, and the English is on the next page, Atatiyeh al Beisi, Va'apicha Yisha Kalami, Rakak Yisei Egdal Mimeka, Vayomar Paro el Yosef, Rein Asati Yosecha al Kol Eretz Mitzrayim. When Paro appoints Yosef as the viceroy over all of Egypt, what language does he use to do so? He says, I'm going to make you the viceroy, and only my throne, my Kisei, will be above yours. But you, I will put you al kol haaretz. I will appoint you over all of the land. So here, these two words, kisei and al kisei hamelachim, being appointed over all the other rulers in the land. This is another parallel that we have to Yosef. So we can already see Yehoyachin being set up as somewhat of a Yosef parallel. Moving on again, and I hope this isn't confusing. Moving on to the next verse that I've given you on the left hand side. So what happens to Yehoyachin? And if you're following along in the English, this one begins, so Yehoyachin put aside his prison clothes. Vishina es bigdei chilau, v'achal lechem tamid lefanav kol yemei chayav. So here, we have two references to the Yosef story. And there are more than this, but we'll stop with these. The English is, so Yehoyachin put aside his prison clothes, and for the rest of his life, ate bread regularly at the king's table. Both of these motifs, being dressed, changing your clothes, and being given new clothes by the king, and having a relationship with the king that involves lechem, that involves bread, as opposed to some other common word for food, like ochel or shever, the word lechem, the choice of the word lechem, I believe, is deliberate. If you look on the right-hand column, in the Hebrew it begins vayalbesh, in the English it begins, he dressed him in robes of fine linen. We have two psukim that refer to Paro dressing Yosef, or Yosef changing his clothes. One is Vayalbesh al Sovig Deshesh, Vayasim Ravid Zahav Hazahav al Tzavaro. He dressed him in robes of fine linen. And then finally, Vayiritsuhu Minabor Vigalach Vaychalevsim Losav Vayavel al Paro. Before he has an audience with Paro, Yosef changes his clothes. Yosef changes his clothes. And then finally, in the next verse, set of verses that I've given you, which we'll just read in the English, and the 7 years of famine on the right-hand side, the very bottom of the right-hand column, and the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the other lands, but in the whole land of Egypt there was bread. Again, that word, lachem. When all Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Then Pharaoh told all the Egyptians, go to Yosef and do what he tells you. So here Yehoyachin also has a relationship, which is reversed, with the king, where one of them is providing bread to the other. And more importantly, the king has given Yehoyachin a new set of clothes. So all of these parallels combined, being freed from prison with that unusual phrase of Nasa Rosh, of Nasayas Rosh, being given new clothes, being set on the throne above the thrones of all the other kings, of all the other rulers of the land, and having this relationship that involves bread, all combine to give us the picture at the very end of Malachim Beis, the very end of the Book of Kings. We have this picture where we are presented with Yehoyachin, the deposed king of Judea, as a Joseph parallel. What does that mean? Here is Yehoyachin. He is a guest, in the most polite, politically correct sense, of the king of Babylonia. He's a political prisoner. And Yehoyachin, as we know, is essentially the symbol for those Jews who went into exile with the first wave of exiles in 597 BCE. And the other exiles who went at the same time always refer to themselves as those who left with Yehoyachin. In Megillas Esther, they're the ones who left with Yechonia, Melech Yehuda, which is Yehoyachin. All the exiles who leave from this period, who are sort of the elite of Yerushalayim, see their leader, or the symbol of their exile, as Yehoyachin. And at the very end of Malachim Beis, the Navi, or the historical, theological writer, is telling us the way in which you are to construct your identity here in exile is based on the character of Yosef. Now, we know these similarities that Yehoyachin has to Yosef, but what are the differences? There are some differences. So what are the differences between Yehoyachin and Yosef? We saw the similarities, both linguistic and thematic, but what are some of the differences?
Maybe Yehoyachin was forced to stay where he was.
Yes.
Yosef, as Arthur pointed out, had a choice to return, but didn't.
Exactly. Yosef is there sort of aggressively, in a very sort of optimistic, proactive sense, whereas Yehoyachin is forced to be here. Yehoyachin is forced to be here.
Also, Yosef was really the power.
Yes, very much so.
Where this man lived by the good graces of the king.
It's almost a mockery of Yosef, right? Yosef, when Yosef is second only to Paro's kisei, and he rules over Kol Haaretz, that was no joke. But when Yehoyachin, meaning with Yehoyachin, it's almost perfunctory, it's almost mocking, you can sort of be the king of all the prisoners. Meaning in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, that's essentially the situation in which Yehoyachin finds himself.
Also, I was just wondering, the children of Yehoyachin, does the Navi speak to that at all? Because I was going to say, the children of Yosef, they were sort of dressing like Egyptians, and that's why Yaakov didn't notice them, according to
Chazal. So in fact, we know Yehoyachin had children, but they play no role.
Okay.
They play no role.
Did they assimilate? I guess that's what I'm trying to get to. Like, in other words, whose children assimilated versus the other?
We don't know much. It's a good question. We don't know much about them. I have to research the question. We don't know much. To the best of my knowledge, they essentially disappear. They must live on because the line lives on. But what happens to them, I actually don't recall. But it's a good question.
Okay. Because don't we say that? Because Ezra and Nehemiah, don't they? I mean, I forgot, but don't they rail against, even the people who come back to Israel, that they were assimilated or intermarried?
Yes, that's the problem. Chapter 9 of Nehemiah and Perek Tes and some of the later Prakim, that is a huge problem. People who come back are intermarried and they're not keeping the laws of Shabbos and they're doing all sorts of things that are problematic. So Nehemiah creates this amanah, this pledge. Which is an exercise, we may see this in the next class, which is really an exercise in Midrash Halacha, in exegesis, creative exegesis of the Torah.
And those are the ones who come back.
Those who stay behind. We know, and as Rebecca mentioned this before, the Jews in Nippur, the Jews who remain behind in Tel Aviv, to the best of our knowledge, based on the archaeology, they actually, unlike exiled communities, other exiled communities, such as Western Semitic communities or Egyptians, who also had been exiled by the Assyrians and Babylonians, in those communities, there's a tendency to there was a tendency that we can observe in the archaeological record to abandon traditional names and to adopt Babylonian and Assyrian names and Mesopotamian names. The only group of exiles that did not manifest that tendency are the Jews. They retain for two or three generations Jewish names, which is an interesting point in and of itself. If we have time, we may explore that theme a little bit more. But it's important to recall that the Jews, likely because they had been promised redemption, maintain this incredible sense of continuity that's really difficult to even imagine. So now, we have Jehoiachin here as paralleled with Yosef, but it's a interpretation of Yosef. Yosef is seen by the author of Malachim Beis, as a political prisoner of sorts. We might read Yosef as sort of a confident go-getter. At the end of Malachim Beis, he's being cast as a prisoner almost of Paro. And that is the model upon which Jehoiachin has been set at the very end of Malachim Beis. And I think it's very much relates to to a similar model for diaspora that we see if you look at the very bottom of that section. I've given you a pasuk from Yirmiyahu. As the Jews go into exile, Yirmiyahu sends them a message. And he tells them, and he says, still part of a longer passage, I didn't have time to cite the whole thing. He says, V'dirshu es shlomair asher iglesi eschem shama, v'ispalu va'adai al Hashem, ki v'shlomahi yelachem shalom. Yirmiyahu actually encourages the Jews of Babylonia to embrace their exile and to really build up the place where they've been exiled to. And the pasuk means, the translation, also seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. This is basically the intellectual justification for the tefillah l'shalmachus. When we say Hanosei Sholam Lachim, when we pray for the government, in England, when we pray for I used to know it by heart. When we pray for the Duke of Wales, and we pray for everybody.
I've been away too long now.
Yeah, right. It's been a long time for me. But you know, when we pray for the royal for so and so and so on and all the royal family, that's based on this pasuk. Because you really, according to Yirmiyahu, you must seek the welfare and the good of the place into which you've been exiled. So Jehoiachin is very much modeled on that. Be a Yosef-style prisoner of exile. One who, while you're forced to be there, is going to be one who contributes to the betterment of the country, but with the proviso, don't make waves. In other words, don't rise above your station. That seems to be the model of Malachim Beis. Okay, now what about Esther? That brings us to Esther. Esther is now farther along into the period of exile. Malachim Beis is writing at the very end, just after the destruction of the First Temple, in the year 562 BCE, at a time when Shivat Zion has not begun yet. The Babylonians are still in power. Cyrus is a dream, is just a twinkle in the eye of history. And they're writing at a point at which Yirmiyahu was promised 70 years of exile, but as we know from later on in Daniel in Perek, I believe in Perek Tess, yes, Daniel in Perek Tess says, what does 70 years mean? 70 years can mean 490 years. We'll see Daniel in two classes. Daniel, at least on one read, doesn't even seem sure how long the 70 years is going to be. Now, by the time we get to Esther, we're already dealing with who's the Persian emperor in the story of Esther. Right, Ahasuerus, and as Rebecca pointed out very importantly, it's Xerxes. Xerxes is the son, and again, all this is beyond the shadow of a doubt. Chazal, for important reasons, some of this information they just didn't have access to, and they did the best they could reading Tanakh. Chazal date Esther to a different time period. There's a book by a fellow named Mitchell First where he compiles literally hundreds of answers, hundreds of solutions to the problem of Chazal's chronology. All of the solutions are fine, and some of them are very meaningful, and we may discuss them in a couple of classes. As long as the answer includes that Chazal's chronology was not correct, then one can give whatever answer they want. The bottom line is that the proper chronology of Megillas Esther And this is Pshat in Tanakh. And if Chazal were greater than us in every possible way, if they had had access to the information to which we have access, Ba'avonoseinu HaRabim, they would have known the same thing. Esther takes place in the reign of Xerxes, and Xerxes is the son of Darius, of the Emperor Darius. He's the son of the Emperor Darius, and Darius was the emperor during whose reign the Second Temple was constructed. So, if Megillas Esther takes place during the reign of Xerxes, that means, by definition, it takes place when there is a temple standing in Israel already. Okay. So now, Yosef appears in Esther as well. Now the question is, unlike in Yehoyachin, yes?
Is there any discussion about, is that completely accepted?
Oh, who are the modern thinkers who accept that the chronology, that it took place during the reign of Xerxes and Bais Sheni is built? Rabbi Liebtag writes about it, or Beryl Wein. So Rabbi Wein accepts the conventional chronology, but he doesn't give a reason as to why Chazal's chronology is wrong. He just says, we don't know. Rav Shimon Schwab also accepted the conventional chronology, and he made the argument that Chazal deliberately proposed an inaccurate chronology because they didn't want anyone to have the ability to be Mechashev HaSaketz, to predict when the Messiah would come based on the writings of Tanakh. So they deliberately attempted to disguise the chronology of the period, especially at a time, and this is a good point, when messianic speculation was rampant. Now, I happen to not find that answer particularly convincing, but it does have a certain internal logic to it, and it's not impossible. It's a plausible argument. So there's a whole spectrum of arguments justifying why Chazal would do what they did, or why Chazal have what they have. They range from Chazal just didn't realize how long the Persian period was because Tanakh only mentions four Persian emperors, whereas we know that there were, I believe, 10. But Chazal, meaning Tanakh, only mentioned the emperors that were important to Tanakh. But Chazal, because they didn't have any other information, the best they could do was assume that this was the entire Persian period until Alexander the Great. And it ranges from there to Rav Shimon Schwab, which is essentially that Chazal knew exactly what the chronology was and they hid it on purpose. But there are a whole range of answers, and more importantly, there are a host of Gedolei Achronim, as well as modern Rabbanim who readily accept the proper dating of Megillas Esther. Okay. Esther reads Yosef in still a different fashion than Malachim Beis. Esther does as follows. What I'd like to discuss are very quickly four parallels that appear in Esther with the story of Yosef. The first I've given you, and unfortunately I really see here I didn't give you the English translation, so I'll make sure I translate. I've given you two columns in the source, Yosef and Esther. There's an Esther column and then a parallel column. All the parallel column, everything in the parallel is from the Yosef story. Now, beginning in the Esther column. So it was in the days of Achashverosh. This is the Achashverosh who ruled from India until the Sudan in the third year of his, and then in the third year of his reign, he made a party for all of his servants. This is a direct quote, almost, of the pasuk in the very beginning of the Yosef story. Vayhi bayom on the right hand column, right across. Vayhi bayom ashilishi yom huledes esparo vayas mishte lachol avadav. It was the third day instead of the third year. It was the third day after after Yosef interpreted the dreams of the butler and the baker, and Paro made a mishte lachol avadav. The very same language, he made a party for his servants. In fact, Rashi commenting on Megillas Esther here says, who were the Saravi Avadov? Who were the officers and the servants who came to Achashverosh's party? They were the Sar Hamashkim, the Sar Ofim, and the Sar Tabachim. He has no reason to make that comment other than to make it blatantly obvious that Rashi was well aware of the parallel to the Yosef story. Why? Because who are the Sar Hamashkim, the Sar Ofim, the Sar Tabachim? That is the butler, the baker, and the executioner or butcher, depending on how you translate it. Those are the three servants of Paro that appear all over the Yosef story. Okay. So already in the very first verse of Esther, we are told to expect that Yosef will be appearing in this story. Just nowhere to look. Now, The problem becomes, where does Yosef appear in the story? So in the interest of time, I'm going to actually just quickly summarize the next three verses. The next three verses, and you can look at them on their own, the parallels will be obvious to those. And if you want to look up the English translations, I've given you the citations at the very bottom of the, at the end of each verse, I've given you the citations. The problem in Esther is that there are three characters who are paralleled with Yosef, rather than just one. So this is already somewhat more of a, this is somewhat of a more complex reading of, or recasting, retelling of the Yosef story than what we found in Malachim Beis. Here, there are three characters paralleled with Yosef. One, the obvious one. So if someone had to be paralleled with Yosef and Esther, who would it be? A person who rises from obscurity to become a royal, to become a, you know, a member of the royal family, who then uses the power that that person has been given to rescue the Jewish people and save their brethren, and who reveals her identity in the context of a banquet. Who would that be?
Esther,
right? So Esther is the obvious parallel with Esther is the obvious parallel with Yosef, and that and there are numerous parallels throughout the book. I've given you just one in column number two. That is the one of the parallels with Esther. You can peruse it at your leisure. Chazal already commented on this parallel. The problem is, it's not just Esther. There's another person who could be easily paralleled with with Yosef. Who is a character who is pressured day in and day out by a person to submit to a sin, and he refuses to do so, and at the risk of his life, he does so. And in fact, his refusal to do so puts his own life in peril, his own future in peril. Who is it? Obviously, Mrs. Deegan said Mordechai. Mordechai is another person who is paralleled explicitly, and the Rishonim already comment on this with Yosef. And finally, this is the more surprising one. At the very last column, Vayefkeda Melech, in the left-hand Esther column, it says, when we are told of the search, after Vashti is deposed, it's important, she's not killed. Chazal say she was killed. Pesukim don't say she was killed. The best that we know about this period in Persian history, it seems that Vashti lived on. But it's not certain, so in this case, I tend to assume Chazal would be decisive. So we can assume Vashti was killed. Okay, well, what happens? Esther now searches for, the king now searches for a new wife. So he could have been obsessive-compulsive about it and really walked around to every single city, in really just a perverted sense, and just kind of looked for women, for pretty women. Instead, Ahasuerus seems to have realized that this was a... that this was not about his own pleasure, this was about finding a queen who would be a suitable role model in a way that Vashti was not. And therefore, he essentially delegates this matter to his officers. And the Psukim tell us, Vayavkeda melech pikidim, b'chol medinos malchuso, v'yikbatsu es kol nara basula tova mar'eh al shushan habira. Tovas mar'eh al shushan habira. He appointed officers to find... He appointed officers to gather all of the women from all eligible bachelorettes from all over the country. This is a direct parallel to Yosef. With respect to Yosef, appointing officers to oversee the collection of grain in the years of the surplus, so that they would be prepared for the years of the famine, we're told Yaseh Paro. That should be Paro. Vayafked Pikidim. Again, the same lashon. Vayafked, the same language. Vayafked Pikidim. Al ha'aretz, vayikbatsu, again that same language, vayikbatsu es kol ochel hashanim atavos haba'os ha'ila, and they gathered up all of the ochel. So again, Achashverosh here is now being parallel to Yosef in somewhat of a strange manner. So what Yosef, what Megillas Esther has done, unlike Malachim Beis, to sum up this portion, is that whereas Malachim Beis, when it was contrasting, when it was reinterpreting the story of Yosef, essentially picked one character and had Yosef parallel that character in order to make an argument about how the diaspora should function, Megillas Esther sees Yosef as pervading the entire diaspora. Every single aspect of the diaspora must be governed by Yosef. Whether that means using your power to save the Jewish people and being confident enough within the context of an empire to actually speak your mind, go against the law, come before the king, even though the king hasn't ordered you to come, to accuse the highest-ranking member of the elite, and essentially saying this person must be deposed because he threatens the Jewish people. Whether it means standing up to a bully, whether it means holding your ground when someone is trying to coerce you into sinning, or whether it be running an efficient bureaucracy, something as mundane as that, Yosef is everywhere in Megillas Esther. Because, if you think about it, Megillas Esther, of all the books that detail a diaspora existence, Esther is the most self-confident. If you think of the characters in the Esther story, they are all acting without regard for the notion that they are essentially a tiny, tiny minority, minority ship of minorities of the people in the Persian Empire. So much so that it's almost suicidal. They run this campaign, Esther and Mordecai orchestrate this campaign whereby they get royal permission to have the Jews and their allies assault Persian citizens in order to protect the Jewish people. The vision that Esther has of Jewish existence in the diaspora is one that is supremely self-confident, and unlike, in the case of Jehoiachin, one that insists that there is actually room for Jewish activism in government, Jewish activism in public policy, and Jewish activism in political life. So that is the way in which the deployment of Yosef in Megillas Esther differs from that which we find in Joachim. And then to wrap up, we have Daniel. Now, let me ask you a question. What is missing? And this is something that Chazal struggle with. This is something that the Rishonim struggle with. What is missing from Megillas Esther? What's the most famous word missing from Megillas Esther?
God.
Hashem. Hashem is nowhere to be found in Megillas Esther. What do Esther and Mordechai never do that you might expect them to do if they wanted God's help?
Pray.
They don't. They never pray. In fact, the Septuagint version of Esther inserts this whole super frum prayer that Esther makes before coming to the king. This whole super frum thing that Mordechai says before he talks to Esther. So the Septuagint, at least, was well aware that if there's one thing that Megillas Esther is missing, it's overt frumkeit. That has to be reckoned with on its own terms. And I think the Rishonim were essentially correct, which is that anyone who reads Megillas Esther and can't see the hand of God in this story is not reading properly. My Rebbe, Rabbi Meir Schiller, has once said that anyone who watches The Godfather and whose life has not been changed as a result doesn't have a soul. So too, I think it's true that someone who reads Megillas Esther and can't see the hand of HaMelech in the events, as well, as likely missing a soul.
When Esther sent the word that she would go to the king, that they had to fast for 3 days.
Yes.
There was no feeling or belief of prayer or anything like that.
I would guess, Mr. Deegan, I think, is right. I would guess that there probably was, but Ms. Deegan is also correct. Which is that it's not mentioned,
right,
which is an important datum in and of itself. If it was there, which we must assume it was, because that was just how meaning you expect anyone to react that way, any normal human to react.
It's like Yom Kippur. This was 3 days of Yom Kippur.
And then they had tefillah by then? They had tefillah.
Well, we know tefillah, meaning Tehillim already talks about a tefillah l'Moshe, already about a prayer that that it's attributed already to the Moshe Rabbeinu.
Even the idol worshippers had a prayer.
But
that was just a different kind of
prayer. Right, Tehillim already.
Which precedes this.
All right, so I think, and Rabbi Friedman has made this point in his Tehillim shir, however tefillah evolves, Tehillim is certainly a part of it. So there must have been prayer, but it's interesting that Megillas Esther focuses, and again, it's a matter of focus rather than a matter of they just didn't, meaning there are scholars who will say the Jews of Megillas Esther just didn't believe in religion, really. I think that's a very facile reading of Megillas Esther. I think it's a matter of emphasis. What were these? Because we have to remember, when Megillas Esther is constructing its narrative and paralleling itself on Yosef in numerous very explicit manners, or as close to explicit as you can be, the question is, what is Megillas Esther trying to get across? The answer is that Megillas Esther is attempting to define how a Jew should live in the diaspora. And the way that a Jew should live in the diaspora, according to the Megillas Esther, is, I think, Megillas Esther, in a sense, is responding to Jehoiachin, to Malachim Beis. Malachim Beis made the point that Jews should essentially, should promote the welfare of their state, but should keep as low a profile as possible. Megillas Esther, I think, is responding to that argument. And doing so, I think, very effectively. The story of Megillas Esther is the story par excellence of Jewish muscle, and which you know, in some respects, in contemporary times, I think the point has been lost. It's become about Jewish drunkenness and Jewish misbehavior and Jewish calls to 911. But in the period of Megillas Esther, this is essentially about Jews protecting themselves and being confident enough to make use of a bureaucracy that they felt we're not guests in Persia. We are, much like I think this is sort of the ethos of most American Jews, I don't think we see ourselves as guests here. I think we see ourselves as Jews first and foremost, but as American citizens who have a stake in America. Yes?
Well, we weren't a captured nation. We moved here because we wanted to be here for the most part.
True.
It's a different kind of diaspora.
So again, the Jews, and that's actually a very important point. Who exiled the Jews? Which empire? Empire exiled the Jews after the First Temple period? In the exile that Mordechai and Esther find themselves in exile. So who put that community in exile? Megillas Esther tells us. These were the people who went out with Yechoniah, Melech Yehudah, and who put them there? Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Babel. The Babylonians put them there. The Persians rescued them from the Babylonians. And as we saw last week, the Persians were the ones who Dafka said, you can now go home. You can go back to Eretz Yisrael. And as we mentioned last time, there is no tradition in all of the ancient world, since Cyrus himself, there is no tradition that has been more positive about the Persians than the Jews, more unambiguously positive about the Persians than Tanakh, which is ironic given the current geopolitical situation.
How can we look with such honor upon Mordechai, who actually could have gone home and taken his niece? Truthfully, he used the term "pimped his niece."
Right.
I mean, to go to the brothel of the king. I mean,
right.
Really. I mean.
So
imagine this day and age.
Right.
Should be brought up on. I mean.
So from an
do a thing like that.
Good question. I think from an exegetical standpoint, and I just want to quickly get to Daniel here. I wish we had more time to spend on it. Putting aside for a moment the exegetical question of how could Mordechai allow Esther to be taken, maybe he didn't have a choice, and that's likely the case. But in terms of why didn't Mordechai go back, that's a fascinating question. I think the same, bless you, I think the same question might have been fairly asked of, let's say, Rav Soloveitchik after he wrote Kol Odi Dofeik. What happened? He wrote this stirring essay about answering the call, and then here you sit at Yeshiva University, much to the delight of his students, but much to the chagrin, I'm sure, of religious Zionists living in Israel. It's possible that Rabbi Shalom Carmi has argued that as important and central as Aliyah is, the Rav had other priorities that were also important that required him to stay here. As Rabbi Friedman articulated so well on Shabbos, does that mean, is that an excuse? Yes, but is it invalid as a result of that? I think not. I think we can imagine a whole host of reasons why Mordechai would have needed to stay in Bavel, and we can imagine a whole host of reasons why it would have been extremely difficult to make Aliyah. If people can't make Aliyah in a time when there's El Al, and when there's a stock market still in America, and when you can have American salaries going to, as meaning not every day, everyone who can get that, but when it's possible to make Aliyah, how difficult must have been, and still so few people make Aliyah, how difficult must it have been when, you know, the odds of you actually surviving the trip to Eretz Yisrael were low, very low.
Let me ask you a question. This is the Talmud was written way after this point?
Yes.
The Talmud was written by those people who stayed in Babylonia.
It seems that way.
Yeah.
There seems to have been a long, continuous community in Babylonia.
But that's the
well treated.
More important of the two talents we have. This is the more important one. So it might not be that all the people who stayed in Babylonia were intermarried and gave up their Judaism. There was a definite center of learning.
Oh, I think if Esther tells us anything, it's that they had a very strong cultural identity,
yeah,
which is important to recall. Yes, I think we'll pick up next week with Daniel. We'll pick up next week with Daniel and Daniel's model for living in the diaspora, and then we'll continue with hopefully the Elephantini papyri. And just one last note: Rebecca mentioned at the very beginning of class that traditionally people assume that there is a blank spot between the end of Tanakh and the Dead Sea Scrolls, or if they don't know about the Dead Sea Scrolls, then the Mishnah. Or Josephus and Philo, if they know about those people. That's the assumption. It is not correct. And we're going to try and do, beginning next week, is fill in that gap. Okay, Ashikala.